This is Tax Update for Saturday, February 4th, 2006. This tax update is Charitable Regulations Meet the Cases. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and the documents supporting the podcast may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document. Such prohibited use would include using this podcast or document as part of a CPE presentation for which a fee is charged without prior permission. This podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, found on the web at www.linebergservices.com. Lineberg Services offers email newsletters of interest to tax professionals to their subscribers, as well as providing a source and library of other interesting facts, such as numbers that are needed quite often in tax practice, to their subscribers from the website. Again, you can visit them at www.linebergservices.com. This week, we look at when theory meets practice. There, we look at the charitable regulations that we discussed a few weeks ago as applied into real-world cases that recently came down. One issue I often run into when I discuss regulations involving taxes with either people on my staff or with other CPAs is the question of, well, that's great in theory, but in the real world, nobody ever worries about that. In the real world, the IRS would never raise this issue. Therefore, it's not a realistic standard for the client to live up to because they won't do it, and I'm just going to ignore it because it'll never become a real issue on exam. My return on that normally is twofold. Number one, even if you're right, if the IRS never in the past has looked at this issue and never in the past has raised it, if in fact you are in violation of those standards and in violation of the regulation, and the IRS decides to look there or decides to start a project here, your client is sitting out there totally exposed and needs to be aware of that fact. I'm reminded of a story told years ago by John Madden during a football game about trying to persuade his quarterback at the time, Kenny Stabler, to run a naked bootleg. Coach Madden explained to Kenny that he would go to the left and the entire line and the rest of his team would go to the right, and that by running that direction, he would be able to go into the end zone without having anybody from the other team following him because they would all follow his team at the goal line heading in the other direction, believing the play had to go that way. Kenny complained that there's nobody to block for him, and those guys on the other side were big, he had bad knees, and he couldn't outrun anybody. And John said, no, they all read keys. They're all going to go the other direction because everybody on your team is going the other direction. And Kenny had a simple response, but what if they don't? Your client's in the same position here if you're relying on the IRS not worrying about this regulation. Maybe they don't. Maybe they never will care about it. But if they do, your client's in the same position as the quarterback on the naked bootleg when the defense doesn't follow the other 10 players. You are about to get tackled by a large, very, very nasty group of people, and you have no real defense. Secondly, for those who don't like the football analogy, we take a look at the fact that are there cases, and have cases raised this issue? And are there cases where these issues have been the basically single issue on the table? There's nothing more real world than a tax court case. And you can ask anybody who's been through one. They'll tell you that it seemed very real to the client when they were sitting there in the court with this issue in front of them after having gone through the entire process from exam on forward to get to tax court and to have this issue decided. To be in tax court, we had to have an agent raise the issue, and we had to have the issue come up on exam. As such, it makes it clear that if we got all the way to tax court, at least in these two cases, the issue was raised, and probably, since most cases don't get to tax court, it has come up in a number of other cases. Therefore, the cases are instructive to learn exactly what the IRS is looking at, and exactly what they are willing to challenge all the way through to tax court. The two cases we're going to consider this week consider the issue of compliance with the regulation 1.170A-13 we discussed for charitable contributions. Now, most of us are aware of the travails of Mr. Hewitt in the Hewitt case and the issue he had with failing to get his appraisal prepared for the stock in Jackson Hewitt that he gave away, and which the tax court later ruled was not publicly traded stock, required an appraisal. He didn't get one, therefore he lost his deduction. But some people dismiss that by saying, well, see, the court's only really, the IRS only really concerned on the appraisal side with these $5,000 contributions and above, and they're not going to really be concerned with my client's non-cash contributions that are all under the $5,000 limit, so I don't have to worry about this. It's not an issue. Those issues would never really, really be raised in court. This week, we have two taxpayers who would disagree with that concept, at least the concept of the IRS will never ask a question. They may not agree with the answers that came back, but they certainly agree with the fact that it was questioned. The first case is the case of Kendricks versus Commissioner. That's Tax Court Memo 2006-9. That was ruled on charitable contributions made by a former IRS agent and former IRS employee in the Criminal Investigation Division, in fact, a 30-year employee, and the court's rulings on her contributions or lack of documentation and inadequacies in the receipts under the regulation. The second case, which even goes after the old line about I put money in the church offering plate every week, was the case of Haas versus Commissioner. That's a tax court summary opinion, 2006.9-9, I should say. In both cases, the court applied Regulation 1.170A-13 and applied it specifically, in many cases, to inadequacies on the receipt itself, in addition to questions about whether the taxpayer's valuation was correct on non-cash contributions, or maybe even a question in the Kendricks case about whether a contribution realistically would have been made. Let's go first to Kendricks. Now, Ms. Kendricks worked for the IRS for 30 years. She worked in the Criminal Investigation Division, and then the final 12 years of her career with the IRS, she was a revenue officer. Now, I think it's pretty clear that the tax court is likely to hold a longtime IRS employee who spent 12 years as a revenue officer to a bit of a higher standard than they might hold an average taxpayer. As well, note that Ms. Kendricks did run this case on her own. It was a pro se case. Now, it cuts both ways. There's the old saying that an attorney that represents himself has a fool for a client, and that probably goes double for a pro se taxpayer. But alternatively, we did have somebody who at least had been around the Internal Revenue Code enough to kind of at least know her way around that code. Now, the judge spent quite a bit of time in the opinion lecturing her on some of the inadequacies of how she presented evidence or where she tried to present evidence in the case, which suggests that the judge was backdoor indicating that she was in over her head trying to play attorney for herself in the tax court. But nevertheless, she probably was more up to speed and more, at least, capable than the average pro se taxpayer. So we might put a little more weight in the fact that she probably raised some issues and the court just said, we're not going to take those. Now, Ms. Kendricks had claimed substantial charitable contributions on her 2000 and 2001 income tax returns. On the original 2000 return, she listed $12,000 of charitable contributions on her return as gifts by check. But during exam, she gave the agent examining her a corrected return, an amended return, that indicated the $12,000 was for non-cash contributions. She had receipts from various organizations to support those contributions, as well as lists of the items and the supposed values of those items that made up the contribution. She also claimed a cash contribution for $6,655 for contributions for a church for which she had a receipt, but she hadn't listed that on the original Schedule A return, so here she brings it up again under exam. For the 2001 return and the second year under examination, she submitted amended returns to modify original filing. In this case, she changed the source of her non-cash contributions. As I recall, the changeover we saw was going from the Goodwill to the Salvation Army. Seems like an easy mistake to make, I guess. When you're making large non-cash contributions, you'd forget who you gave it to. May have hurt her credibility, but nevertheless. And basically, and she added a couple of receipts from what appeared to be churches, and one of the churches, had language that indicated no goods or services had been provided. The other one did not have that language. Now, there were a few bad facts that aren't directly tax-related, but come into play and really hurt the taxpayer's credibility in this case. And the court notes these in a section in the opinion just before it goes on to give the formal opinion. And it's not coincidence that they're located there, and it's also not coincidence that they become somewhat important in dealing with the credibility of this taxpayer. The court noted that in 1998, she filed a bankruptcy petition. Well, that by itself doesn't make you a non-credible person, but the facts stated in her position under penalties of perjury hurt her case somewhat. She stated that at that point she had total assets of $4,100 and liabilities of over $118,000, and on her filing with the bankruptcy court, she reported that she had no monthly expenditures for charitable contributions. Now, add to that that on her 1998 and 1999 individual income tax returns, she had reported each year charitable contributions of $15,000. Those two facts don't look good next to each other. The court appears to draw a conclusion that Ms. Kendricks was lying either to the bankruptcy court or on her tax returns, or what unfortunately in many cases the court will decide in a situation like this, hey, maybe it was both. So we are going to just kind of quietly ignore that problem. We're going to say that this really, really hurts your credibility because we believe you will tell a falsehood to improve your position in a legal proceeding. And that's really troublesome for tax returns. The court also went on to note her employment history with the IRS at this point. Again, I don't think it's coincidental that the court decided to kind of point this little fact out, which arguably was not relevant at the point toward the issue of whether she'd made the contributions, but it pointed out her background there. I suspect that the court does this to justify holding her to a very strict standard of compliance with the regulation 1.170A-13, because as you will note, the stated reason the court will give for many cases for disallowing her deductions in this fact pattern is going to be inadequate compliance with that regulation. It appears the court had reason to believe maybe the contributions weren't made. In fact, the IRS states that in their position, based on her bankruptcy filing, they find it very, very difficult to believe she could have made any of the contribution that was or anything near the contribution levels that she claimed. But the court, rather than going down that road, simply points to the regulation, says you failed to meet that burden, therefore it's out. That's troublesome. This raises the issue of a bad facts case, creating problems for us in other cases that don't share those bad facts. The issue is that since the judge ruled that our problem here was the fact that Ms. Kendricks did not keep adequate records, and her records were inadequate or her receipts were inadequate, that could be applied in another case where the taxpayer does not have the bad facts. And that's probably the biggest danger we face in a case like this. So let's go through the specifics of her situation. At the beginning of the opinion, the court cites provision we discussed earlier about the requirements for a contribution in excess of $250 found in the code at section 170F8A, including the necessity of having the charity indicate that there was no benefit received from this contribution. For below that level, the court then goes on and notes the regulations still require you to have a canceled check, a receipt, or some other written form of evidence that is plausible to support the contribution made. The court then also goes on and recites the similar requirements for non-cash contributions, discussing the specific issues at the $500 level that we find. Now we go and look at applying the case, the actual facts of the taxpayer's case, to the law and regulations. In this case, the court first lectures the taxpayer, and this is the first of two cases where the taxpayer gets lectured, I think, because she decided to represent herself. The court decided to indicate to her at this point she represented herself, and because of her background as a revenue officer, she should have known better, is kind of the impression I get almost from the way it's worded. The court indicates that the taxpayer had been warned that she could not introduce this one particular receipt the way she did, as basically an attachment to a brief, that she had to bring it out in the court proceeding and put it on the record. But the court then goes on, and after telling us they couldn't consider this receipt in any event, they go on and tell us why it is inadequate. And this is the potential problem we find in this case, and this is where, if you're in a exam situation, you might find an agent reciting this one back to you. The court went on and stated that there's a single letter that says you gave to the church $732 during the year to the West Angeles Church of God. That basically appears to be what the letter stated. It did not have a detailed breakdown telling us when she had made those contributions or in what amount those contributions were made. And it also did not have the one-liner that no goods or services aside from an intangible religious benefit were provided to the taxpayer in exchange for this contribution. The court indicated that since the only thing on the record was a total contribution of $732, the court was going to say there was no evidence there were single contributions below $250, and since if the contribution was above $250, she had to have this particular disclaimer, the court was saying that even if we let this in, it wouldn't count. So that is one very important fact to watch for on your client's receipts. Again, is it likely a court would go here if we didn't have all the other bad facts? Very possibly not. However, is it possible you will find a taxpayer being recited this in an exam? That one's possible. The court then went on to consider a receipt from the Gospel Temple Baptist Church and notes that this receipt also failed to indicate if goods or services were provided. Now, in this case, the court goes through and it allows one contribution listed on there because that was less than $250 individually, and the court notes under the regulations, if the individual contribution is not above the $250 level, the requirement of the goods and services recitation is not there. Therefore, if the charity indicated that certain contributions were below $250, that receipt was adequate under the regulation for less than $250. Therefore, the court allowed in that case. Now, what you're going to find at the end of the day is in both cases, the allowed contributions and the allowed other itemized deductions were less than her standard deduction amount. So the court could afford to be generous in this case, shall we say. The court didn't really get over to the question as to whether they found her entire story about the contribution so implausible to deny the whole thing. Now, in 2001, the taxpayer's documentation was again examined. This time, she had another receipt from the West Angeles Church we discussed earlier, but this time, it appears it did indicate no goods or services were received. They had added that blurb that's fairly standard, been around for years, finally got added to this church's receipt, and therefore, she was allowed her $713 contribution for this charity. The Gospel Temple Baptist Church receipt, however, still had the same flaw as the previous year, and the court again went through and disallowed contributions, individual contributions in excess of $250, and only allowed those contributions that were less than $250 at a time. Now, the court then went through her non-cash contributions with a similar analysis. Again, the taxpayer gets lectured about trying to get evidence in via attachments to the brief routine, claiming, you know, you were told you had to bring this out in the court case, you didn't provide this to the IRS ahead of the actual case, therefore we're not going to consider it. Again, an unusual case, and in a pro se case, a little bit different, but it would appear that the taxpayer and the judge may have had some disagreements during the trial. We're not sure, but certainly the court reminding the taxpayer that they had lectured her that she couldn't introduce evidence later certainly suggests that there was some interchange between the judge and the taxpayer that didn't go well for the taxpayer. Now, the court on the non-cash considers the IRS's view that her claims that she made these large non-cash contributions lack credibility because of the taxpayer's bankruptcy filing. Basically, the IRS said she had $4,100 of total assets per her bankruptcy filing. We don't consider it plausible that she could have made contributions worth this amount, non-cash contributions, especially because she told the bankruptcy court she had no charitable contributions. Basically, that wasn't a monthly expense, and it certainly seems implausible somebody that deeply in debt would be giving away everything they had, or giving away in things of this high value. The taxpayer attempted to explain how she got the goods, and unfortunately her explanation sounds more like one that would have been better left totally unsaid. She goes on and indicates that, well, most of the goods she got from the sons of a deceased girlfriend of hers who needed $3,000 so he could buy drugs. That just doesn't sound like a good thing to say in open court, that you basically paid $3,000 to somebody so they could buy drugs, and you took their goods, and you took all of their property for that purpose. That doesn't sound terribly good. Or that she had purchased or picked the goods up off the street and then refurbished them, so that's why they were worth so much more. Open question at that point, then, if she didn't hold them for a year, would they have been capital anyway? Secondly, was she in the business of doing this? And that might raise us down a whole unreported income situation for somebody in this deep financial trouble. Well, we won't go into any of that. She also claimed that she got a distribution from her thrift plan, and she used that, but she also testified that she needed the thrift plan distribution to live on. So it seemed, again, implausible to the court that all of this worked. Now, after going through all that, which suggests a high level of skepticism about the amount of contributions claimed, the court did allow the receipts from the Salvation Army and Goodwill that she had were authentic. She said, okay, we agree these are authentic receipts. The value would be questionable because she didn't really have any good evidence about how she acquired this stuff and the acquisition cost. The court noted that, but said, we buy these are valid receipts and something was given to this organization. But then the court, in what will be troublesome for other clients, goes on to point out that these specific receipts did not say no goods or services were provided in exchange for these donations. And based on that, disallowed the deductions on each of the claims donations that were greater than $250. Only one of her non-cash contribution receipts actually had the no goods or services language that allowed the court to go on to the question of value. So now we finally get to, here's the one receipt she had that indicated she didn't get anything of value. And then the court finally had to deal with the taxpayer's estimate of value, and it found the support for the value is inadequate. The court didn't accept. The charity's receipt had said these estimated in value to be $5,000. The court didn't accept that. They believed the estimate came from the taxpayer because she had this detailed list of information and numbers that added up just under $5,000. So the court indicated it was their belief that the charity had not really independently valued these goods, but in fact had just taken the taxpayer's value, so the charity's value was not useful to prove value. Important to note, nothing in the regulations requires that the charity prove value. The question the judge was deciding here was the fact the charity put a number on there, was that to be considered evidence of the value of the property? And the judge ruled in this case, in this fact pattern, that evidence was not adequate. It does not mean that charities have to estimate the value, or if a charity doesn't estimate that value, you don't get the deduction. So be very, very careful here. The regulation didn't require that. The judge is merely pointing out that he was not going to accept the charity's $5,000 number as proof of value. The judge also pointed out that he had doubts about how it was put together. Since it was filed as part of the amended return, It thought it was created after the fact and seemed to lack credibility. Therefore, it seemed to be put together and may very well not have existed in a timely fashion. Remember, we do have the requirement that you must have that contemporaneous receipt, and he had doubts that it was contemporaneous at this point. As well, since the taxpayer provided no evidence, the acquisition cost or method valuation seemed to be only that she had claimed less than what she had paid for it, and we don't know really what she had paid for it. And the court found that not to be an adequate valuation method anyway. After that, the court did brush by the Cohen rule, and it considered whether the Cohen rule could apply in this case, and decided it didn't have to decide. The judge did point out that in certain cases, the tax court had used the Cohen rule to allow some charitable contribution even when there was an adequate substantiation under the substantial compliance theory. The court indicated some skepticism, or the judge did, some skepticism as to whether substantial compliance really worked, considering Section 170A's requirement that the deduction only should be allowed if substantiated in accordance with the regulations. But the court decided in this case, because the total amount they would have allowed under a Cohen analysis was not enough to get her over the standard deduction, the point was moot, and they didn't have to decide it. Now, clearly, this was a case where there were serious problems with the taxpayer's credibility, and that made a big difference in how this case was evaluated. But nevertheless, because of the language the court used and the fact that the court actually justified most of the disallowance here based upon inadequate receipts, indicates to us that we need to be very, very careful with our charities and make sure that charities are issuing receipts that will stand up to analysis and will stand up under the regulation. Also, we may need to check with our clients and watch. If we see the receipts go by and they appear to be clearly inadequate, you probably need to warn the taxpayer that if that receipt doesn't have the wording that says no goods or services were received, that receipt could be thrown out by the IRS, or the IRS could disallow the charitable deduction in full, or we could at least be arguing it with an agent. And whether or not we actually get it in the end, I would prefer not to argue it. You know, it's much nicer to have it go away. Remember, they have until the extended due date of the return to get the documentation contemporaneously under the regs. Therefore, you might suggest for any significant contribution where they don't have the no goods or services language, it'd be a good idea to revisit the charity and get a statement that says no goods or services were provided. Well, maybe you think this is a really, really off-the-wall case only because this was a former IRS agent. She should have known better, and the court was merely going to lecture her. Well, let's point out, later the same week, another case came down in the small court, in the small claims cases, in TC Summary 2006-9, the Haas case, where the same basic issues ended up being applied, but this time to a pro se taxpayer who was not a former IRS agent. Now, again, to be fair, this particular taxpayer had some real issues with a casualty loss they claimed on a stolen truck. And the court had real issues with the amounts they claimed there, and that may very well have impacted how the court felt about the charitable issue when that came up for decision as well. But we still have to look at the justification the court used here. And again, I recognize this is a summary decision, it's not precedent, but it is important to realize that we have an agent and we have a judge who all came down and applied these rules and threw out the deduction. Well, the first charitable contribution to face scrutiny for Mr. Haas was the one we hear quite often. I put money in the church offering plate every Sunday cash, and no, I don't have a receipt. And, well, I just know it was, you know, $5 a time, $10 a time, etc. The court specifically used the requirement in Regulation 1.170A-13A1 that some form of substantiation written must exist. It didn't, and it disallowed his cash contribution to the church. Wasn't huge, but still, the court went ahead and nicked him for that one. For non-cash contributions, the court did not find there was adequate substantiation. He valued the asset based upon his belief of what he would pay at a thrift shop or rummage sale, and his list of items donated gave a general description of the items given. And the court found discrepancies between his claimed values of the items given and what was actually listed on the tax returns that broke both ways. The interesting problem was the court noted that he didn't describe the condition of the goods and other items, he just listed what was there. Now, we all know that quite often that's exactly what a client will do. You will get a list, I gave a bag of clothes to big brothers, big sisters. You know, I gave a bag of clothes, value at X dollars. That is probably going to be inadequate if it is truly challenged. Now, this is one where you do play the issue of at what level do you begin to get concerned. My guess is, in reality, if the client is claiming significant non-cash contributions and they all come down to receipts that have nothing more on them than bag of clothes, you may have a problem on exam if the agent wants to go there, and these cases would justify that. My take on a case like this, we say, how much bother is it worth, is, well, I would ask the client, there is a question for challenge here, and we don't know if Cohen does or doesn't apply. Note that this particular case, in the Haas case, the court went ahead and allowed an amount that it felt was adequate, therefore apparently applying Cohen, even though, as we noted in the Kendricks case, that court had questions whether you could. But in this case, I would say a taxpayer, my goal to taxpayers, well, that's good, but if challenged and pushed, it would have to be given up because there was a good chance, or you could lose it if challenged, simply because the court may not grant you the Cohen position, and the IRS agent may say you've inadequately documented per the regulations. Now, if it's not worth it to you to be able to defend it to that level, then okay, fine. I think I've got enough to go on with what you gave me to take this deduction. But you've got to realize that don't come back and, you know, be very, very concerned that you didn't get the deduction if you're examined. It is one that could be thrown, and technically you could face penalties for that if the IRS really decided to play nasty with you. It is a case where the clients need to make a decision as to what level of backup they're going to give. We do have the history of Cohen being allowed currently. Luckily, the Kendricks case didn't push that judge over the edge and get us a statement that Cohen could not work at all if there are inadequacies or substantial compliance is not a valid method for substantiation or not a valid way to get at least some deduction. So we do have at least that going for us, but clients do need to be aware of the issues that we face. Other key things to learn from this case. It's very, very important to learn from both cases that the taxpayer's credibility is crucial when we deal with these issues. In both cases, my own reaction is the result truly occurred because there was lots of evidence that suggested the taxpayers were not credible. They were willing to overstate, and basically they didn't come out and say this openly and bluntly, but it seems to be the impression that the taxpayers would have lied about the amount they had contributed because it would benefit them from a tax standpoint. If the court and the IRS begins to believe your client would lie, you have major problems because much of what's on that return depends upon what the client says or the client's position, what the client testifies to. And once you lose that, you will lose a lot of substantiation. Therefore, suggest to clients that positions that, if uncovered, would question their credibility are serious problems and may be more serious than the amounts involved. Finally, for those of us who work with any charities, it is important to note that in both of these cases, we had inadequacies of the charity. Well, actually, in the Kendricks case, we had lots of issues where the charitable contribution receipt did not have the required language, and that allowed the court to throw out the deduction. I would suggest that we make sure with the charities we work with that they understand the importance of that language being on the receipt if, in fact, no goods or services were provided to the taxpayer. While it is the taxpayer's responsibility to make sure they have that statement, reality is charities who don't provide it and who find people who make contributions losing deductions because that statement's not there may face problems raising money in the future. It's not a good situation to end up in, and the charity should make sure that they put that language on their statements and make sure it is there whenever it is valid and make sure that they issue that as part of their normal statements. In many cases, churches issue these notices out of computer software programs that we would hope, if they've been updated recently in the last decade, would have that footer almost automatically generated. However, what often happens in churches and other nonprofits is things don't get upgraded. And I suspect in some of these cases, we're looking at these receipts being generated either from an old book of receipts manually, and nobody's ever gotten a new set, or nobody ever changed it when they went and got it reprinted, or being generated from a computer software program they got years ago. The computer hasn't died, and they're continuing to use the software program to generate these receipts that they purchased well before the regulations went in, but a computer that's still functional. And that creates a problem for us as well. But our charities do need to get this right. Well, this has been Tax Update for Saturday, February 4th, 2006. Again, Tax Update is presented by Lineberg Services, available on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Remember, we're sitting now into February and into the fun part of tax season, so hopefully everybody's having fun and enjoying themselves these days. And we will come back to you hopefully next Saturday with another update here. Reminder, we are now in the month of February, so oh, by the way, and I know in tax season it's easy to let things slip, remember, Valentine's Day is coming up on the 14th. Kind of mark that on your calendar. This is Tax Update for Saturday, February 4th, 2006.